Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We have a very good show coming up this hour, as we've been doing many programs about the Trump administration and possible coordination with Russia. We will ask this hour, what have we learned about thorough investigations of a presidency from Watergate? What have we forgotten about thorough investigations? Are there indications that the Trump presidency is in trouble? And what is it that both of our guests would like to know about possible Russian coordination? And what are their concerns about the many, many news stories that have emerged since shortly after the president, well, actually before the president was inaugurated? We have two guests with us this hour of the program. We're happy to have John Dean with us. John Dean served as White House counsel for President Nixon from 1970 to 1973. He participated in Watergate, and then he helped uncover it with his very memorable testimony to the Senate Watergate Committee. We'll remind you of some of that testimony as the hour goes on. He is author of many, many books, including The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, Blind Ambition, about John Dean's time in the White House, Conservatives Without Conscience, and Worse Than Watergate, a book that he says he wishes perhaps he had waited to use that title for the next book that he may write, which is probably going to be about the Trump presidency. John Dean, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure, always.
Yeah, great to have you here. Also joining us is Scott Armstrong. Scott is an investigative journalist. He's the executive director of Information Trust. He is a president of Searchlight New Mexico, which is this investigative news organization. He was a staff writer for the Washington Post, and he, as a young man, both John and Scott were very young when they were involved in this Watergate business. He was a senior investigator for the Senate Watergate Committee, and their uncovering of Alex Butterfield revealing that Nixon taped his meetings in the White House, including meetings with John Dean, all of them, really was crucial in this investigation. He's done some really interesting things. He organized a conference, a reconstruction of the 62 Cuban Missile Crisis. Fidel Castro came. Anatoly Dobrynin participated. He convened a conference on free expression, which brought Salman Rushdie to the U.S. for the first time after the death fatwa. And he's done many other things. And Scott, we're delighted to have you with us as well. Hi.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Well, the news is coming so rapidly. Before we get into Watergate, let me ask both of you. CNN has just reported that James Comey is likely to report next week that Donald Trump did push him to end the FBI probe. Does that indicate to you, John Dean, that it's an obstruction of justice? Could it be?
It could very easily be. And the more I've thought about what Comey went through with Trump and his position and his inclination, is that he probably, with other agents, gamed out what might happen if he went over to that dinner with the president, and the president indeed tried to get him to halt the investigation. And I suspect he came back and not only made notes, but was totally debriefed, and he may end up being the key witness in an impeachment proceeding against this president. And Trump, being Trump, just walked right into probably what was the most dangerous meeting he could have ever held.
Oh, fascinating. And Scott, is there a possibility, you asked that all-important question of Butterfield, that this meeting could have been taped that Trump had?
Well, I don't know about taped. I mean, we always look for the best evidence. But the main question is, Comey is very much like in a position like John was, in the sense that there was a president who was instructing, attempting to get his wishes followed that would have obstructed justice. But the question is, what really happened? What were the circumstances? What precipitated it? One of the problems with special prosecutors, we're now at the stage of having a special prosecutor, is that they prosecute crimes. And what we need now is for somebody to pursue what happened. Why did it happen? What is it that Trump may have, what are the guilty the things that he may have experienced or believed would be exposed that would cause him discomfort, that would make him want to obstruct justice?
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. The open-ended question is the one that now needs to be pursued.
Well, then we have, lo and behold, the next day, the foreign ambassador and the foreign minister meeting with Trump in the White House at a meeting that was suggested by Vladimir Putin, of all people, and he said, okay, let him come on in, after he had just fired Khamenei, leaks classified information. Will that not be investigated as well? It was a pretty weird thing to do, John.
Well, if there is not collusion, there is a remarkable disposition in Trump, both during the campaign and during his presidency, to do everything that Mr. Putin might like having him do. I mean, it's just, it's remarkable the influence that Putin is having on American politics and the American presidency. I mean, if he invested in Trump, he certainly has been paid off. If he didn't invest, or if he did invest, he didn't have to, if this is Trump's disposition. But Trump's presidency is under the shadow of treason. No question. This president really needs to clean that up.
Ooh, that's a pretty significant thing to say, under shadow of treason. Scott, do you agree?
I'm not sure I'd use the word treason. I'm not sure that that's a meaningful concept to Trump. Trump is following his own predilections, his own wishes, and we need to know more about what those are. I think the you pointed to the meeting with the two Russian officials in the Oval Office, and that's part of the context. I think what we need to do is explicate the context. Sam Dash, who was the chief counsel for the Watergate Committee, for whom I worked, the man who basically brought John into the position as their key witness. Sam was very fond of saying that in a legislature, that the preferred function, he was quoting Woodrow Wilson when he was Woodrow Wilson was a professor, but that the preferred function of legislature should be to inform, even before it is to legislate, that the public needs to be informed about what's happening, mm-hmm. So we can determine what it is that needs to go forward next. And that's the stage we're at now. We need to be informed about all these aspects of Trump's relationship with Russia and his relationships with his own financial, with his creditors. There are a variety of things that seem to intersect very closely together.
Scott, you wrote an interesting piece in the Times last week, I think, in which you talked about Watergate, and you talked about how bipartisanship was crucial then, and it wasn't totally bipartisan at the beginning, and bipartisanship will be crucial here. Where were there attempts at partisanship, and John, chime in on this as well, during Watergate, and do you see the same kind of partisanship now that may make it difficult for this investigation to be thorough?
Well, I think all such matters are partisan. We had, during the Watergate Committee, and as we went into it, it was a highly partisan atmosphere. There were a number of people, I would call them McGovern Democrats, who were unhappy with the Democratic Party, but they were particularly unhappy with Richard Nixon's conduct of the war. They wanted things to move in a different direction. We approached Watergate with a great deal of cynicism with it, and then when John became a witness, we learned from John, before any of this became public, that Howard Baker and his staff had had contact with the White House. They'd been coordinating, and in an effort to derail the hearings, to essentially blunt the thrust of the hearings. And it was from the very first, I remember the first executive session we had in private, prior to any public hearings, we were talking about subpoenas, and we were talking about the scope of the hearings, and Dash was putting forward this notion that they had to be open. We had to explain to the American public all the different things that had happened. And Baker objected at every turn. And when it finally would come down to a vote, he would usually accede and go along with the majority so that he wouldn't appear to be dividing things. But he was definitely partisan. After the session ended, just as I was getting ready to leave, Sam Dash grabbed me by the shoulder and said, follow Baker's administrative assistant. And instruction. He went out, the administrative assistant left the meeting, went downstairs, got in a cab. I went down and got in a cab, followed that cab. His cab went to the old executive office building. I, of course, couldn't go in. I came back and reported that, and Dash said, well, you know, it's a shame because I think he must be meeting with Fred Buzhardt, who was the person who'd taken over the cover-up from after John Dean had left. He was the lawyer who was in charge of the cover-up. And I said, well, just a second. I picked up Sam's phone and called Fred Buzhardt's office and said, can I speak to the administrative assistant? He got on the phone. He said, why are you calling me here, Scott? I said, just to show you're there. The next day, he had to resign. He resigned from the committee.
Hmm.
And so we had that kind of, that was what was lying in the background all the way through. There was a stage, that's how the tapes were discovered in some sense.
Right.
There was, at the beginning of July, John had just testified, but at the beginning of July, one of the stenographers, and in those days, you have to remember, Washington was still a segregated city, not just black and white, but no women were on the professional staffs. Women who would today be young lawyers and would be on the professional staffs were stenographers. And one of them, who I didn't understand them to be of a different species, I treated them very well, but the Republicans often didn't. And one of them came forward and gave me a memo, let me look at a memo, that Thompson had dictated to the file that cataloged all of his meetings with Fred Buzhardt. And these were meetings that nobody on the majority staff, the Democrats, we didn't know about this at all. This was something that was done strictly but on the Republican side. And it was an effort to undercut John Dean's testimony, to impeach his testimony by suggesting that he was in charge of a cover-up and had contradicted himself inside the Justice Department and elsewhere. And when I looked at it, I realized it had quotes. And that's what led to, we were then calling in satellite witnesses because there was no regular corroboration for John Dean other than witnesses. John had remarkable memory. I mean, a flawless memory.
Still does.
But it did not. We did not have documentation of those meetings. And so we called in a fellow named Alexander Butterfield, who was one of the people most intimately involved in the president's daily events. And after having gone through every single conceivable way of recording the president's day, I then handed across this memo that Thompson had written about his meetings with Buzhardt, his interactions with Buzhardt, and Butterfield looked at it and said, oh, this is very interesting. There are a lot of quotes in here. And he then proceeded to say there were none of the systems he discussed could have dealt with that. And the discussions went off in a different direction, and the minority counsel, Don Sanders, asked a series of questions and then went back to one that had been raised by John's testimony. John had said that at one point when discussing the cover-up with the payments to finance the cover-up, with Nixon, that Nixon had gone into a little alcove in his old EOB office and lowered his voice. And so Sanders said Dean had the impression that the meeting might have been taped.
Mm-hmm.
Possible that Dean knew what he was talking about. And Butterfield looked up and said, no, there's no way Dean could have known. And then he picked up the this document that Thompson had dictated about his interaction. But he said, but that's where this came from. And then I think he thought we were trying to trap him, that the Republicans and Democrats were somehow trying to squeeze him, but in fact, this was uncoordinated. He said, yes, as you probably know, that there's an automatic taping device in each of the president's offices, and that's where this came from. And that was the first we'd heard of it, and we then sat there and got him to document the system before he went home that day.
Amazing. And you were happy there were tapes, weren't you, John?
Oh, delighted. In fact, Sam Dash, when Scott first gave him this information, one of his reactions was, my God, maybe this is a setup, and they're going to undercut all of Dean's testimony. So, Sam, I was out of town. I was in Florida. I was in the witness protection program by that time.
Hmm.
And they arranged to have me come back up to my home in Alexandria, where I could meet with Sam and another aide, Jim Hamilton. And they came out really to confront me and get my reaction to the fact the taping was probably of all my conversations. And Jim Hamilton later described a smile coming across my face as Sam was revealing this to me, because I was thrilled to learn there was a taping system. And I said, you guys are going to learn that I testified very, very narrowly, because I thought one of my conversations for sure was taped, if not all of them. I didn't know. So it turned out, indeed, they were all testified, excepting the one that I suspected I had been taped. That entire reel disappeared.
That was the gap? Was that the 18-and-a-half-minute gap?
It was bigger than the gap. It was a six-hour gap.
Whoa.
And it's probably one of the most important tapes, and it disappeared right after my testimony about it. When I told the Senate, I said, get that tape. And they did, but the people who got it were Fred Buzhardt got it from the Secret Service, and it has never resurfaced.
Interesting. Back to Donald Trump for a moment. You've written about this and tweeted about it a lot, John. Let me hear both of you respond to this. We don't get any answers from the White House about what's going on here, what the deal is with the Russians, why indeed there's a back channel with the Russians, why the ambassador was there, what kind of... There's this huge cloud that keeps getting bigger and bigger every day. And I believe you said, John, this could all be cleared up in a matter of a week if the president were forthcoming and said, what? What does he need to say to put it to rest?
Well, what he could say is he could have his White House counsel or his attorney general call Mr. Mueller, who's the special counsel now, and say, listen, I want to appear in front of your grand jury. I want everybody on my staff who is even tangentially been thought about to appear. I want you to have access to my tax returns. I want you to have anything and everything you want. This is absurd. I want it cleaned up, cleared up, and ended ASAP. Now, if Trump is correct that this is all fake news, that's what he would do. But every signal he's throwing is exactly the opposite, that they're covering this up. They don't want to talk about it. They want the subject matter changed. They fired Comey because of his investigation. They may fire Mueller before it's over.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, I agree with John about the way in which Trump could address the questions and clean them up. But I would recommend that both for the president's sake, if he were truly sincere about wanting to clean it up, but mainly for the public's sake, that this should be before a congressional committee, either the Senate or House Intelligence Committee, as they're now configured, or if they chose to create a select committee, which would have to be done expeditiously so you don't lose ground. But, yes, you could have a week of testimony. And the fact of the matter is the testimony would be largely self-serving and would largely be attempt to explain things away. But it would set a baseline. And then the committees or other investigators would go about interviewing all the other satellite people, the people that knew. People forget how many people know about things that you and how much evidence there is. That we now have, because of terrorism, we collect information about every financial transaction above $10,000, almost anywhere in the world, anything that moves through the banking system. And so all these records can be put together. We can have, whether or not there are tapes, we can at least reconstruct things in some level of detail by talking to all the people involved. And once that complete picture is done, I think you'll get a much better explanation of what happened. I don't think it's going to be simple. I think it's going to be very nuanced, and it may not even be reconcilable. The Russians may have had one purpose in doing certain things, and the Donald Trump's people may have had several purposes. And then the ultimate question is, why the obstructions? And those could be for any number of reasons. But once, as they become more material, as they become obvious that he's acted in a way that is meant to obstruct an official criminal investigation, then it becomes problematic. You get very close to the level which impeachment becomes something that everybody can talk about. Now, this is going to take more than a year, and so we're going to be very likely to have another election before we're finally going to get to the final denouement. And that could mean a different composition in the House. It could mean a different attitude in the House. Even if the Republicans return, they may have seen a public that's no longer as happy or willing to be patient with a Donald Trump.
I think you've said, John, as well, that probably impeachment wouldn't be on the table unless the configuration of power changed after the midterms.
I think that's correct. 2018 will affect that issue. Unlikely Republicans would start impeachment hearings during the first 2 years of Trump's presidency. The special counsel is really below the radar right now. His investigation will be in a grand jury or the FBI. They're not going to put press releases out on it. So Scott's right that, you know, the public does need to be educated about this, and we need to look at, you know, what's happened to our democracy if the Russians have had this kind of impact on it, to prevent it from happening again. And they'll be out there for 2018, and we still have no real remedies for dealing with the kind of interference they can have in our electoral process. So, you know, I think 2018 is going to be a big election for Trump. It's going to determine his presidency. If he indeed loses control of Congress, you can bet the last 2 years of his first term is going to be consumed with inquiry. Mm-hmm. And that is not pleasant.
Let's talk just a little more about this financial dealing, because there have been a lot of questions about, you know, Russian bankers and why Kushner met with this Russian banker. The bank was under sanctions. And what's the back channel? Is it about money? We haven't seen another thing about disclosure. Trump could disclose his tax returns, which, of course, we haven't seen those as well. A couple questions. One is it Mueller able to get those tax returns pretty quickly? And number two is, don't you think all of this might happen more quickly because so many people are leaking things? I don't know where they are in the intelligence community or the White House, but a lot of people are putting forth a whole lot of information, Scott.
There's several layers here you've got to look at. Yes, they can get the tax returns. There's a process by which either the congressional committee or an independent counsel can get tax returns. It's not too complicated. It's pretty direct. I'm not sure that's going to be that significant. Remember that the baseline, the single most valuable thing to the Russians would be lifting of the sanctions. There were a series of sanctions that were applied, three different levels of sanctions, applied by the United States and by some of the allies, that as a result of the Ukrainian situation, the movement into Crimea and so forth. And to get those removed would have been a home run. It would have been a grand slam. And so that was probably the single highest goal that the Russians could have had. But looking at that in context, that being the goal, then you have the question of how might they compromise, how might they get people to cooperate with that. Any number of ways, any number of routes. We know that Trump has had a number of financial dealings with Russians. He says they're not Russians. Well, in fact, they're Azeris, people from Azerbaijan, the former Soviet Union, one of whom lives in Moscow, the other lives in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. But there are other Russians and other Ukrainians that have financed just things in the United States, have been involved in buying properties from them. And the Trump methodology, which we've kind of all known since the campaign, there have been any number of books about this, in selling real estate, there's always a little bit of slippage between the sales price and what we call the tax stamp price. Mm-hmm. That is to say that a wise real estate person pays the minimum amount of federal of tax because of the tax stamp that's put on it. But in between, there are little other transactions. Sometimes they're in the form of kickbacks, forgivenesses, whatnot, usually done in a manner that makes them quasi-legal, if not legal. But they're the sorts of things that would shed light on what was going on here and who the benefactors were. Trump, I think you have to look at, as from the Russians' point of view, as a chump, as a guy who was an easy mark, who was somebody who was in desperate straits and would give you a good deal on certain things, and if you met his price, would be likely to kick back some money to you. So you get into a series of take those issues apart, and each one of those becomes a potential motive mm-hmm. for wanting to cover the whole thing up. Mm-hmm. So this financial transactions part of this is essential, and it's mm-hmm. very detailed, but the information is available. Treasury Department has a whole department, the sub-department, the FinCEN, so-called, that collects this information, and each transaction is cataloged, and you begin to pull those together, begin to look at the actual papers, begin to talk to the people who are involved in the transactions, and you begin to get motives for things. And then if you match those up with the overall Russian motive, the forgiveness of sanctions, and the desire to destabilize NATO, which seems they've done very well this week without this transaction. Trump did it on himself, and the movement, the effort to keep at risk all of the satellite countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union that are now potential NATO members or already are NATO members. We have a formula. And the narrative of that formula is documented as you begin to get subpoena power and begin to pull these materials together.
Hmm. When you say, John Dean, that America is going to be tested, and you said this before he even became president, as it has never been tested before, with all of this investigation going on and with foreign policy having significant changes, are getting out of the Paris Climate Accord, there are so many things happening, the immigration ban, what's happening with deportations, et cetera. There are some major things happening, and I'm wondering if the investigations will take such a long time. What do you think will happen to the country as a result of this radical change in our democracy?
Well, I had two thoughts in mind when I said that the system is going to be tested. It's at two different levels and at different times. First of all, I was very concerned about Trump's true ignorance about the way the system works. I don't, here's a man who I don't believe has even a very good newspaper knowledge of the way Washington works. We know he has more golf courses than he has books. He does not read, does not do briefings. Apparently he likes graphics if he takes his intelligence briefing. So lots of maps and pictures are coming in, apparently even some videos. His absorption of information is very low. And I just don't think you can have a president who's ignorant and feels that the system is going to work very well. That's at one level. However, he's not stupid, and he's going to learn where the levers are and how the system works, and his authoritarian personality, something which I've studied in other works, troubles me. He's the kind of guy that once he figures out what he can do, could be very dangerous. Now, that's where the system seems to be working is he did yield and fire General Flynn, and that was largely because the Washington Post leaked it. He knew of Flynn's problems. He knew Flynn was working for the Turkish government. He knew for many days that he'd lied to the vice president before he finally took action. So it was really the leak that shows that he is somewhat responsive to public opinion and the so-called enemy of the American people, otherwise known as the American news media. So that's encouraging. And the fact now we have, he's so bungled and invited a special counsel by firing Comey, he's got somebody who's really there to keep a check on him, can force his aides into grand juries to talk about what he's doing and can keep a good eye on him. So that albatross is also a check.
Let's pause for a moment and we'll welcome phone calls. We're talking about Watergate. Do we learn anything from Watergate and use that historical knowledge as we look at what's happening now with the investigation of possible ties between the Trump administration and Russia, and we're looking at the special counsel, the congressional committees, the importance of those, partisanship and all of this, the possibility of impeachment, what happens to the presidency with all of this investigation going on. We have John Dean with us, who, you'll remember, was White House counsel for President Richard Nixon from 1970 to 1973. He has written about that experience in a number of books and gone through hour after hour after hour of those recordings that were done by Nixon in the White House, author of Starting with Blind Ambition, Conservatives Without Conscience, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. He is a CNN contributor, and he is with us. And Scott Armstrong is also here. Scott was an investigator on the Senate Watergate Committee during Nixon's presidency. He was a young man in his late 20s. He's an investigative reporter, co-founder and president of Searchlight New Mexico. Was a reporter for a number of years for the Washington Post. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. our Facebook page. We love to read your messages there. Always is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Ed in West Allis, hi.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Bonjour. I have a comparison-contrast question. I find absolutely nothing redeeming in Donald Trump. He's one of the most obscene, self-absorbed individuals I've ever known. But I'd like to know, especially in light of last year's biography of Richard Nixon by Mr. Thomas, if there was anything at all redeeming about Richard Nixon.
John Dean.
I think there was. I talked to Evan when he was working on his book. There's another book out, even more recent than that, by John Farrell on Nixon, that even did some deeper digging than Evan Thomas did. I think the China initiative was certainly always going to redound to Nixon's credit. He had one vision in foreign policy. That was to bring at least one or more generations of peace. Those are pretty noble motives, and I don't think anybody can belittle him for that. The problem is, of course, he's the first president to have resigned. He resigned over Watergate, and as University of Wisconsin historian, the late Stanley Cutler said, you really can't deal with Nixon without Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
When one of his colleagues tried to do that, Stanley's reaction was, that's like talking about Hitler without the Holocaust. So that's a pretty extreme example. That's the negative that Nixon has to deal with. But I think that Donald Trump could end up making Richard Nixon look like a choir boy.
You talk about, at one point, something you wrote, you talked about Nixon being a barely articulate man in private. So you got the private Nixon and the public Trump are similar. The difference is Nixon, you write, who was so highly disciplined, prepared ad nauseum for press conferences, had huge briefing books, which he used as a management tool because he got the departments and the agencies to get answers to all the questions he would be asked. Boy, they were very much opposite in that regard, weren't they? Donald Trump seems to be flying by the seat of his pants usually.
And Nixon, I said, was not articulate in private. He was articulate
right. In
public,
right. Highly
articulate, because he virtually memorized his speeches.
Did he?
Yes.
Huh.
And he would get up and give what looked like an extemporaneous speech that was virtually a recitation of a draft he'd written and reread, reworked on, and committed to memory. And he's just when going through his tapes and the hours after hours of tapes I did listen to, I realized he could barely get a sentence out. Not unlike Trump, who in public is not terribly articulate. Maybe Trump is more articulate in private. I don't know.
Hey, why don't you speculate on that, Scott? Because I've always wondered why he doesn't use more elevated language or have historical references. Why he's not a better speaker, Donald Trump. Is that on purpose, do you think?
I think there's a certain populism that
that
shoots from the hip and enjoys it. But John made a profound point before when you asked him about if things continue to go bad in other areas, climate change, decisions, immigration and whatnot, what happens? And I think Trump kind of likes those opportunities to throw things back in the face. It fits his populist image. But it also will circle back on him, because it's going to lead to more and more leaks, more and more dissatisfaction inside the bureaucracy. And then he'll accuse the leakers of having violated national security and of being invented by the press. He seems to like to have that both ways. So you'll have this cycle of things spinning increasingly out of control. And it seems that as soon as he causes one of these things, he doubles down on it. There's a certain exponential factor that he is almost guaranteed with him. He'll turn a small issue that could be corrected by a clever spin or a correctional statement by his staff, and he'll go back the other direction on it and make it an even bigger issue. Nixon was much more controlled. Nixon had suffered from two problems. One was he had the Watergate was, in some sense, the reasons for Watergate were an aberration. He was very concerned about his personal finances. He had taken some money that were so-called campaign contributions that went to his private benefit, maybe as much as $1 million in $100,000 chunks, not a lot of money in today's standards. But he did it largely because he felt he was competing with people like Kennedy. He was competing with people that were born into wealth, and so he didn't have that silver spoon. He felt he deserved that. And that was an aberration within one side of him. The other side was that it was a national security state that was not well understood at the time.
Mm-hmm.
People have forgotten that one of the things that John did when he testified is he brought a box of documents with him, this family jewels, as they were later, some of them were called, that were turned over to the committee. The committee didn't do that much with them. We used them where they were relevant to Watergate, but they, by and large, became the source of what became known as the Church Committee that did a whole era of reform of the intelligence community, and that was something that was lying in the background. But that was a Nixon that wanted, that thought that that was the dimension of the national security state, that that was a given, that that was something that he was entitled to do, that he was entitled to make to what we now see as abuses of process, abuses of the electorate and of the population. He thought was something that was the norm for the president. Trump is in a wholly different domain. He's trying to change things, and he's changing them by blundering forward in every direction. I don't think there's a way to explain rationally why he speaks the way he does. It's a kind of calculated chaos. And when that chaos gets bound up in government, when it becomes part of an executive order, it becomes an abusive process and begins to violate certain constitutional norms. So regardless of what happens on the Russia thing, he's already on his way to creating a whole series of problems for himself down the line.
Mm. Jim in Hollandale. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. The one question I have is, what do you guys think about who's going to be the Sam Rivlin that's going to come along and force Trump to adhere to the Constitution?
Whoever wants to go first.
Well, John, I'll handle. I'll go on that. Well, first of all, it's not likely that the Senate or House are going to start any kind of hearing that's similar to the Senate Watergate Committee hearing until this thing progresses further. Neither the I think there are four committees that are currently in Congress that are investigating, and they're all doing it behind closed doors and likely to stay there. So I don't think there will be public hearings, but there are any number of potential candidates who could, we'll never have another Sam Rivlin, but could be a comparable chair of a select committee if indeed in its wisdom, the Congress decides to inform the American people about this, which Scott is right. And if they don't do it, they certainly should get a commission to do it so people can know what has happened to democracy in this digital age.
Well, why do it all behind closed doors? Don't we have a right to know what's going on?
We do. And the reason it's being done is because a lot of it is raises sources and methods issues that could be, could put at jeopardy lives of intelligence agents who've collected this information. So we, it right now is just pretty much looking at the cloak and dagger side of it and trying to get the information from the intelligence agents. There are ongoing investigations that they don't want to disrupt, and that was. That was actually handled pretty effectively during Watergate. For example, Archibald Cox did not want me to have immunity, but the Senate went ahead and granted me immunity. I solved the problem because I had no interest in beating the rap mm-hmm. and tying them all up. I had the case that Oliver North would have some years later, but that wasn't my goal. My goal was get to the bottom of it and end it.
I keep thinking as I'm talking to both of you, I'm thinking of It's a Wonderful Life, and what if both of you had never been born? I'm wondering what would have happened with Watergate. I mean, seriously, if you hadn't testified, John and Scott, if you hadn't found out about the tape system, I wonder what would have happened.
Well, there are always hypotheticals. I think the the most important thing about Watergate was the approach that Sam Dash got Sam Ervin to take, which was this notion of let's tell the story. Let's let the public understand how campaigns work mm-hmm. and how White Houses work and how the Justice Department works. And John was the perfect vehicle for that because he was willing to tell a story that involved his own compromise of integrity, and he was precise. He was extraordinarily well counseled and disciplined in his testimony, but it wasn't necessarily these personalities. It was the approach to the notion that our government is a grand and great democracy, but democracy exists and the rights in democracy exist by exercising them, and you exercise them every day. And there's the answer to the fellow who called in's question is Senator Burr, Richard Burr, from
yes.
I think it's from North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
He's the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He seems to be predisposed to being bipartisan. He and Senator Mark Warner from Virginia, who's the Democratic vice chair, they seem to work well together. There are things they'll have to avoid. There are things that are be sensitive, but they can get some things declassified. But they can hold public hearings. And if they have that desire to let the public know how this happened, what the range of it is, what's the range of confidence you can have in your government,
mm-hmm.
it has a tendency to restore confidence, has a tendency to get people to do the right things and to build consensus and to come to a resolution. And I think they don't have to do all that much. They can variegate these fields while the other things, while the Mueller investigation goes on as a special prosecutor's investigation, and while we basically go into an election year and let people decide, do they really want to go forward with this kind of a government, this kind of chaos, this kind of intrigue for no reason, or do they want more to be known? And if they do, there'll probably be some change in government, and it's likely to be followed up by a more aggressive committee.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that committee is well led, John?
I do. So far, we have no indication that it's not. I think it is being slow walked for a number of possible reasons, including partisan versus just the mechanics of getting the information out of the intelligence agencies in a timely fashion. The fact that they've hired no new staff and it's the existing staff that's taking the burden has got to be slowing the process down. So they're not committing the resources to it the way the Senate did during Watergate, and that's not expediting anything.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network.
What I had hoped to do in this conversation was to have the president tell me we had to end the matter now. Accordingly, I gave considerable thought to how I would present this situation to the president and try to make as dramatic a presentation as I could to tell him how serious I thought the situation was that the cover-up continue. I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day.
John Dean, many years ago. Jim, thanks very much for your call. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My concern is that with this impeachment talk or the current treatment of Donald Trump appears to be due to the fact that some of his policies are not popular with the media or with a wide range of people. He got elected by the country for enforcing our immigration laws, building a wall, repealing and replacing Obamacare, and having NATO pay its fair share, et cetera. There's a lot of policies that a lot of people might not like, but to have them, if you disagree with those policies, it seems like they are attacking him in many different ways that are leading to this impeachment problem. And I guess my question would be, as they go forward, I'd like your guest to comment that if they go forward with the impeachment process, you know, President Obama did a lot of things, including misusing the IRS.
All right, let's get into other. We've got our hands full with Nixon and Trump right now. But what about this? The caller seems to, he's a Trump supporter, that there's nothing there. What are we investigating? Is it people who just don't like his policies, John Dean?
Well, we're investigating whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian hacking process. That's the core of the inquiry. If there indeed was, it is tantamount to treason. There's nothing more fundamental to our system than free elections, and to have a foreign adversary come in and influence that election with the collusion of a candidate who prevails would be devastating to our process. It would change the whole nature of democracy. So this is pretty basic stuff. And if he has colluded, he needs to come forward, and that's the end of his presidency. If he hasn't, he needs to establish that quickly and explain why this is all fake news, because it is affecting his policy.
Mm. Let's go to Terry in Hayward. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Yeah, I, as a 17-year-old, just graduated senior in 73, remember watching John Dean, of course, testify. But what I wanted to comment about is I couldn't tell which party Howard Baker belonged to. I couldn't tell which party Lowell Weicker belonged to. They were very nonpartisan in their questioning of John and Haldeman and Ehrlichman and all these guys that came.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Scott on that. Were they bipartisan? Was that atmosphere prevalent, Scott?
Well, Baker did his best to appear that in public. The Weicker was definitely bipartisan. Weicker was predisposed against Nixon. On the other hand, we had a Democratic senator, Herman Talmadge, who had taken money from some of the same people Rebozo had. One of his aides went to jail for it, for taking money during an interview that I was conducting with the person about the whole question of funding Nixon through the back door through Rebozo. So there were all sorts of Talmadge was a Democrat but voted with the Republicans quite often. But bipartisanship comes about when people begin to see that the inevitability of getting to an answer that will work. The previous caller asked about why isn't this just about policies? No, I mean, the fact of the matter is I'm sure that 90% of the Republican senators are very bothered by the Russian situation now. They're very bothered by Russian tampering with the election, and they're very bothered by the fact that there appears to be some opportunities for collusion. Maybe in the House it's only 70%, but those are the Republicans. The vast majority of them are very concerned about these issues. And so when they become so concerned that it becomes more important to purge the problem, to answer the public's questions, to get this off the agenda in some authoritative way, that's when you get to real bipartisanship.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. I know that you have very deep, and you've written extensively and spoken extensively, concerns about this presidency. You even, I don't know if this is true or not, but there was a piece in, I think, The Atlantic, John, about you, in which you expressed concern right before he was about to be inaugurated, that you were having nightmares about this president.
Yeah,
are you still?
I'm not, fortunately.
You're not.
I'm not, but I did, and I'd never had that happen before. I never, during Nixon's tenure and during Watergate, ever had any nightmare about Nixon. I was always relatively comfortable that Nixon, in the end, would honor the Constitution, and that would be supreme in his mind, that if they came knocking on the door and it was over, he would leave. I'm not so sure about this president. If he were in the comparable situation and had to turn over tape recordings that were incriminating, he might say to the Supreme Court, well, you've got the court martials. I have the U.S. Army.
Whoa.
Come get them.
Whoa. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. I guess another thing I was thinking is that both of these men could have used, but then they would be different personalities, a bit of a sense of humor. You remind us that Donald Trump may smile occasionally, but he doesn't laugh. And
he doesn't laugh.
I can't remember Richard Nixon being too jovial a guy, Scott.
Always forced.
Yeah. Thank you both very much. Appreciate the hour.
Thank you.
Our thanks to John Dean, who was White House counsel for President Richard Nixon. You'll recall the importance, his importance in American history, actually. He helped uncover Watergate, but he participated in Watergate as well. And it turned out all those conversations he had with Richard Nixon in the White House were taped. He has written extensively about those years and about other presidential administrations. Scott Armstrong, an investigator on the Senate Watergate Committee, and got to the information that there were tapes in the White House. He's done a lot of writing and was a reporter for the Post, Washington Post, for a long time. Thanks so much to Gretchen Brown for producing the show, to Colleen Leahy on air production.